Conservative. Constitutional. It's the Andrew Cooper Writer Show, keeping you informed on what's going on right here in Kentucky.
Today on the Andrew Cooper Writer Show, we'll continue to dig into what we've learned looking at some of the financial reports coming out of the Kentucky state-level races, and we look at how some of these are shaping up. The Herald Leader publishes an opinion article where leftists start to see the problems with a surveillance state, but then follows it up by painting some dystopian reality of what they think they will be used for, the surveillance state would be used for, such as targeting trans people and women seeking abortions. This is becoming a new trend on the left to think that we're just going to be conservatives, if they have their way, will just be hunting down women looking for abortions and trans people. Crazy world they live in. So we'll have all that and more today on the Andrew Cooper Writer Show. But first, I hope everybody's having a fantastic Friday. And I wanted to start out by covering a little bit of a response to a show I did earlier this week. And if you want to check out old shows, you can head on over to theandrewshow.com. Once again, that's theandrewshow.com. And the show in question is titled You Pay for a Drag Show. And in the show, I had talked about how taxpayers had funded a drag show in Moorhead, Kentucky. And as I do with many of my subjects or topics, I will post about those on social media. And with this topic here, I'd posted it on Twitter, some pictures from the event of children giving dollar bills to these drag show sexual fetish performers, and I posted that with the following statement. Taxpayer-funded drag shows attended by children in Moorhead, Kentucky. The Kentucky Republican legislature could have stopped this by passing Senate Bill 147. They failed. These images are from a drag show put on last weekend by Pride of Moorhead. According to Pride of Moorhead's website, their sponsors include Downtown Moorhead Inc., Moorhead Rowan County Tourism, and Pathways Porch Lights. All three of these sponsors are primarily funded by the taxpayer. All three combined receive well over $12 million a year in taxpayer funding. It's one thing to claim you just want to be left alone. It's another thing to steal money from the taxpayer to fund your celebrations surrounding who you go to bed with and your fetish shows. So, kind of summing up a lot of what I covered on that particular story from earlier in the week. I believe that was, Wednesday's show? I think I talked about that. But in response to my social media post, I started drawing a lot of attention, of course, from the leftists attacking the points I'm trying to make, or at least trying to, because they did exactly what I think most of us that engage at all online with these crazy people expect them to do. Ignore how insane of a reality it is that we have children handing dollar bills to sex workers performing drag shows in the on the taxpayer's dime in Moorhead, Kentucky. They just ignore that crazy reality, and they don't even want to admit that it's like a problem. And I think this is kind of a big issue the left has with a lot of their points. They honestly have a hard time embracing just how crazy their positions are. If they will, instead of just saying, yeah, drag shows are sexual performances, but we don't think it's a problem for kids to be exposed to them, that's the parents' decision. They could make that argument, and we could have an argument about whether or not that is the case, but they know that's a losing one. They know that if they admit to things like drag shows are sexual performances, or if they admit that, you know, they are advocating for mental health practices on trans youth, such as things like, oh, we need to shove socks down girls' pants so they can feel what it's like to be a guy, and if we don't do that, they'll kill themselves. That's a real position that these so-called trans activists have. If they come out and say that, well, that's a losing argument because it's crazy, because they're crazy. And so, in response to my social media posts drawing attention to the taxpayer funding of drag shows, they decided they wanted to defend the practice. And I want to go through what a few of their points are and deconstruct them, because I think it's incredibly important that we engage in the culture as conservatives, but because so much of what our politicians do follows what the culture's happening. Politicians will only act on certain things as long as they feel like the culture that the people won't throw a fit about it. In fact, things that they don't even care about, they will suddenly pretend to care about and actually might do something about if the culture says that it's expected that a politician do those things. For an example, in this country for a long time, it was expected for a politician to say things like, America is the greatest country in the world. And saying anything to the opposite would lead to you immediately being removed from office. But nowadays, we have people unwilling to condemn saying things like, death to America, which is pretty extreme. That's pretty crazy. And so with that in mind, that engaging in this culture and shaping our future is important, I think when we hear these arguments, it's worth deconstructing them and understanding just why they're wrong and crazy. And so I want to deal with a few of those tweets, few of those comments back to us. Let's start with this first one here. It says, so local taxes paid for this. I ask, I know two of the three are local, but not sure about Pathways Porch Light. If it is also local, you should be happy, as your tax money didn't go there and there was local control. He then went on, and another tweet, because somebody responded, pointing out something important that I'll go over in a second. And he said, the point is local control. If their community wishes not to have it, should it not be up to the local community? Or does this need to come down to the state ruling for everyone in the state? The conservative position should be to leave it to the local district. So let's deal with the first part about the claim that somehow none of my tax dollars went to fund this. First, I know that Morehead Rowan County Tourism is a government entity as designated by the state. Second, Downtown Morehead Incorporated, according to their 990, has received pretty much all their funding through a government grant. Now, it's unclear on if that money came from the city, state, or federal government. And then Porch Lights money, Pathways Porch Lights, comes from all over, federal, local, state. They receive tens, well over $12 million, according to their Form 990, in government grants. But it really doesn't matter whether their dollars are coming from city, county, state, federal government, because they are all fungible, and they're all receiving dollars from everybody else in the state, and technically the country. And that's something leftists always seem to conveniently forget, at least when it comes to their viewpoints, the things they want to fight for. Because let's say that all of these entities only got money from their local city. Does the county of Rowan and the city of Morehead not receive dollars from the state? Is it not in projects and in areas that they are actually supposed to be the overseers of? And at the end of the day, they are actually supposed to be the ones to fund them, such as things like water systems, sewers, other utility systems, that they have received federal or state funding or grants in order to pay for? Of course they've received money for that. And this goes back to the old adage about what if your mom gave you money for rent? This is an old parable, but it just demonstrates very easily how fungible money is. For let's say your rent is $500, and you go to your mom and you say, hey, I don't have money for rent. Can I borrow $500? And your mom gives you $500 to pay for your rent. But then you pay for your rent. But then you turn around. Suddenly now you have $500 of your quote unquote own money. So you go ahead and buy a TV for $500. Did you spend your mom's money or yours money? Well, technically, I guess you spent your money, as the money your mother gave you, let's assume, handed right to the landlord, but that freed up now $500 you could spend elsewhere. And so the same thing happens when it comes to these local governments. But what about the claim that, well, this is local control, so we conservatives should be fine with it? I'll be covering that after this short break. You're listening to The Andrew Cooperator Show, your source for Kentucky politics. And you're back with The Andrew Cooperator Show. For the break, I've been dealing with arguments that leftists make defending the practice of locally funded drag shows. And I was dealing with one of the claims. The next claim we want to go over is that because we are conservatives, or perhaps you are a Republican, you should be for local control. That's what one of these leftists claim. It was the local government that decided to pay for this. And, you know, we went over how it's not really locally funded because tax dollars are fungible. But it was decided on locally, and, well, that's a small government conservative thing to do. So to the claim that conservatives must be for local control, that the whole line of local control that we hear leftists and now we hear conservatives saying all the time to kind of throw in our faces, well, it all was started by Republicans in our state legislature. I'm sure they heard it elsewhere, but the first time I ever heard it was elected state level Republicans claiming that small government conservative meant that things should be done locally and not at the state or federal levels like ever. And that local control is what conservatives should be for. But it's never been a part of my conservative ethos. It's never been a part of my principles. And why is that? Because while we believe in government being efficient, and sometimes, many a times, in my opinion, that means that local governments are more equipped to deal with the few but necessary things that our government's role should be, the few things that I think government's role should be in, I think are better handled at the local level because they're more equipped to handle things on a case-by-case basis, or at least a smaller case-by-case basis. Take something as simple as a basic food stamp welfare kind of program. At the federal level, it's administered. They set certain poverty levels. They set certain asset levels. They set all these things. But if that was all handled at our local level, the tax was collected locally and then administered locally for that type of action, well, then one, the what is poverty? You know, federal government sets a limit across the country, but what poverty is locally actually depends greatly. Because poverty in somewhere like New York City might be $80,000 a year. But meanwhile, poverty out in Eastern Kentucky isn't $80,000. If you're making $80,000 a year in certain parts of Eastern Kentucky, you're living in a pretty nice 3,000 square foot house with maybe 10, 20 acres. You're not struggling at all. So, you know, that's like just a small example of how local governments, I think, may be better fit to administer a lot of government programs. But I do believe in the Constitution, and I believe in certain rights laid out by them. And that doesn't mean that because your local government has decided to violate those rights, it now is okay. I don't care if it's the federal government, the state government, your local government. Nobody should be able to violate your rights. Nobody should be able to steal from you to fund things that are at best questionable. I mean, is the assertion that the left is trying to make is that, well, yeah, the federal government and the state government can't seize your money for just like any reason at all. But if your local city government votes to take your stuff just because, well, you know, local control, you should be okay with that. Now, we as conservatives believe the smallest minority is the individual, and the smallest minority's rights must be protected at all levels, and it doesn't matter whether it's state or local or federal. Your rights deserve to be protected from government in general, and I'm sorry that I believe the individual doesn't deserve to be forced to pay for a sexual fetish drag show that kids are handing dollar bills to sex workers in Moorhead, Kentucky. So that's a small thing. Now, here's another claim here that we saw on this post that I made where I was calling out this taxpayer funded of drag shows. Here's one here. It says, none of y'all's business. Isn't that what you all preach? Small government, blah, 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 blah. You do know you have LGBTQ plus Republicans in local and state offices throughout this Commonwealth, and that's not a question. Worry about your own party. Clean up your own house. First, it's a mighty assumption. Keep in mind, I was calling out taxpayer-funded drag shows. And it's a mighty assumption that gay people in general would be for this. And that's a pretty big assumption making Kentucky, considering that Senate Bill 147 was supported by the leadership of Banned Conversion Therapy, which is a group I generally don't agree with, but that is a LGBTQ rights group. And Senate Bill 147, the first trans-identifying elected person, spoke in favor of the bill, said he supported the bill. And it banned, Senate Bill 147 banned specifically tax dollars being used to fund these shows. So the claim that all gay people, all LGBTQ people must be for this stuff is ridiculous. And once again, if you're not harming others and if you're not using my money, you're right. I really don't care from a governmental side what you do. Now, my belief in personal freedom doesn't rob me from having the ability to have an opinion. I can have an opinion on what you're doing. And because I have the right to free speech, I can even vocally voice that opinion about what I think about what you're doing. But it's a big difference for me to have an opinion and be vocal about it than to ask my government to throw you in jail for doing something I disagree with. So if you're not harming others and you're not taking my money from me to fund it, then I really don't want my government stepping in to do anything. But in this case, you are one, taking my money, and second, you're involving minors in a sexual performance, and that's wrong. And then another common argument, and this is the last one we'll finish up on, is that these pride events, like these drag shows, these pride festivals, help local businesses. Here's an actual quote. It says, "Drag shows, brunches, and events are very profitable for local businesses. You failed to mention that, of course. Let us also remind everyone that all anti-drag measures failed in both Tennessee and Florida, too. These harmless shows aren't going anywhere, no matter how much you misconstrue." First, the failures of Florida and Tennessee has to do with shaping of the bills. You start to learn what the arguments are, and clearly this hasn't been argued in front of the Supreme Court yet, so we'll put that to the side. But let's talk about the claim that these help the local economy. There are a lot of things that can help local economies that aren't drag shows and pride events. You could do things like art festivals, fairs, normal gatherings, court days, gun shows. I mean, straight dollars and gay dollars do spend the same after all. And the benefit of all those other events is that you don't have kids shoving dollar bills into someone's clothes. And second, I do actually want to challenge the idea that these events, that these shows actually do make a local economic impact for these governments. It's already hard in Kentucky in general for local governments, counties, and cities to make revenues off of tourism because of how our constitutional taxing structure is set up. Local governments, local cities, and counties, they can't charge a sales tax. They can charge an occupational tax. They can charge a profitability tax on LLCs. But it's kind of hard to capture dollars from tourism. Now, if you're just charging a sales tax, you could, but not the case here. They can't do that. But I don't know exactly how much money the city has given to Pride of Moorhead to sponsor their events in the county there. And I don't know exactly what the costs are, but I know I've never seen a study of like any actual individual Pride event and looking at how they actually economically impact. What was the cost to the government, to the local government, to the people of that area? What was the cost to put on the event versus to the government versus how much did in revenues the government pull off of it? I don't see that. But I have an indication and a belief that these pride events aren't actually very profitable for anybody. You know how I know that? Because every single time I see a pride event, it's being put on by a nonprofit who, outside of just the events, has to have individual fundraisers to help raise money to fund the events. When's the last time you saw somebody do a cakewalk in order to fund a art festival, in order to fund your local fair, in order to fund your local rodeo or gun show, or do you see court days in Mount Sterling having to do a cakewalk to fund it? No, of course not. Why? Because these events are profitable. They can pay for themselves. They actually do help the local economy. But these drag show events, they're clearly not helping the local economy all that much if you can't afford to put them on with just private money. If instead you need actual government taxpayer-funded sponsorships for you to be able to even exist. And the reason why they don't make money is, one, a lot of the businesses coming into this are from out of county, out of city. But two, because frankly, the people going to these events are communists. They don't spend a lot of money. You know how I know they're communists? They don't spend a lot of money and make poor life choices? Because they're going to pride events in the first place. They're not exactly your ideal big money spenders all the time. They show up in spirit. They may give a few bucks to the performer. But the chances they're actually going to help your economy, based upon the fact it takes nonprofits with fundraisers to fund these events, seems dubious at best. Well, coming up after this, we'll move on to talking about elections. We'll have that after this short break. You're listening to The Andrew Cooperator Show, your source for Kentucky politics. And you're back with The Andrew Cooperator Show. So, obviously, primaries are coming up here soon. We're getting down to the final few weeks. Three weeks and a few days or so. Not that far away. I believe it's the 21st next month is Election Day. 21st next month, if I am not mistaken. And it is, I believe, 21st. So, 21st next month. And so, we are taking a look at some of these interesting primaries. And I wanted to call out one specifically that I do actually find interesting. I'm paying a little bit closer attention to now. Coming out of Western Kentucky, where you have incumbent Richard Heath. You may remember him as running for Ag Commissioner against Jonathan Schell about a year ago or so. But Richard Heath facing off against Kim Holloway in the 2nd State House District. And what's interesting about this race is what happened in 2022. You see, Kim Holloway initially filed to run against Richard Heath in the primary there in 2022 as a Republican. But it turns out one of her document signers who sign and attest that she's can run for office. It's, you know, basically here in Kentucky, in order to run for office, you only need two signatures, but there's certain requirements on those two people who sign. And one of them wasn't qualified to sign for Kim Holloway in that Republican primary. And so she was legally disqualified off the ballot. But Kim Holloway, anyways, ran as a write-in for the 2022 general election. And in that 2022 general election, as a write-in. I mean, let me explain how this works so you understand how important this is, okay? In order to write somebody in, you have to, one, know they're running, two, know how to spell their name, three, know you really, really want to vote for them, and then four, decide to write their name, show up, and then handwrite their name in on a ballot. That is not a super easy thing to get people to do. It's just not, because you got to think, right? That it's not just like name recognition. So if I give you a list of names and I say, hey, vote for a name you kind of recognize or understand what's going on, you'd say, oh, okay, yeah, I recognize that Kim Holloway name. Yeah, I'll vote for that. But if they have to actually write you in, that's not an accident. They didn't accidentally vote for you. They meant to vote for you. And they wrote you. I mean, that's so big. I know maybe those of you who don't pay as much attention to politics, but the fact somebody has to, doesn't just checkmark your name, but write you in is huge. And so in that general election, she got 17.4% of the vote as a write-in, or 2,300 votes. Because keep in mind, too, there was no Democrat candidate even running. And so she's running as a conservative, farther right than Richard Heath. So I don't think she picked up a whole lot of Democrat votes necessarily. And yet, she pulled in 17.4% of the vote without even her name being printed. And what's interesting about this House district, now it hasn't had a primary in quite some time. Richard Heath has been in there for a while. And the last primary was actually 12 years ago. But in the primary in 2012, less than 1,000 voters showed up. Only 956 voters showed up in this primary. And remember that even some of the better districts where a fair amount of people show up, you might see on the high side, 4,000 and a rare occasion, 5,000 primary voters showing up to vote in a state house primary. So even if quadruple the 956 number show up this time in the primary, so 4,000, Kim Holloway has already garnered enough votes as a write-in candidate at 2,300 to be able to win that. That has some staying power there too. I mean, like I said, they knew she was running and knew how to spell her name and wrote it down. She's got to be carrying over a good chunk of those votes already. So coming into this election, I would not be surprised if she has like an initial set, 1,500 votes or so, just coming into it. So if 4,000 people show up, she just needs to win over 700. And that's a base too. And what makes this race even more interesting, Calloway versus Heath race, is that Richard Heath has just under $14,000 in money raised. And Kim Holloway, meanwhile, has $17,000 raised. And this race also isn't getting the same attention that the incumbent is for races like the Meredith, Stephen Meredith down in Bowling Green there, Killian Timoney in the Lexington area. It as an incumbent, they are getting more attention, and that's because what Meredith and Timoney, while they have bad voting records, and Heath doesn't have a stellar one either. He has some pretty iffy voting records, in my opinion. But Timoney and Meredith have been kind of a poster child for I will do the bidding of the school unions. I'll do the bidding of the horse park mafias. I'll do the bidding of the hospitals. I'll do their bidding, and in return, you're to back me in these elections. And if I'm going to go bat for you and I'm going to attract all this negative attention, I mean, keep in mind, Killian Timoney has the worst conservative rating in the House. And Stephen Meredith has an F rating from the Family Foundation. So these are not high-ranked conservatives, but the argument from these kind of individuals like the horse parks and the hospitals and the chamber and of commerce at the state level and all these people is that these people have been going to bat for us, voting how we want them to. And if they get bumped off, then when we go and ask other people to vote the way we want them to, it becomes harder and harder to convince them. But if we can defend them and we say, hey, don't worry, vote how we want to, you to. And if you come under fire, we got your back. And also we have a track record of being able to defend you. That makes it easier on them. But Kim Holloway, Richard Heath, that race hasn't attracted that same amount of attention. So I don't think he's going to get a whole lot of outside money. So you have a organized, locally supported, better funded challenger in Kim Holloway right now, going up against a very long time incumbent, a challenger who, Kim Holloway going against Richard Heath here as the challenger has already in an election against Heath garnered enough write-in votes to potentially beat Heath off the bat. So that might, the House District 2 race is a very interesting one indeed. And it also can help kind of send a little bit of a message because, 2022, we saw three incumbents bumped off in Northern Kentucky, all of them committee chair heads, all of them viewed as powerful longtime people, all of them viewed as completely untouchable. It made other people feel safe to vote the same way they do. But if we have another longtime committee chair, which Richard Heath, he's a agricultural committee chair. If we have another longtime incumbent committee chair that's not Northern Kentucky, but Western Kentucky, that is taken out by a grassroots candidate, grassroots effort in that local election there, it sends a message to everyone that you can push too far. and even having a, albeit bad, but for our current Republican caucus, kind of run-of-the-mill voting record, that's what Heath has, the fact you can lose on that as an incumbent, well, that sends a pretty clear message to everyone else that, hey, you better start voting in a lot more conservative manner. You better start voting how the grassroots wants you to, because anybody can come up on this chopping block. It's a very, very interesting race indeed. I'm so fascinated by that race. I will be keeping an eye on it. Very interesting. Well, coming up after this, we have an article, a op-ed coming out of the Herald Leader regarding Flock cameras in Lexington. A local woman wrote an article about how it's going to be used to track women trying to leave the state to get abortions. We'll have that after this short break. You listen to The Andrew Cooperator Show. As always, if you want to reach out to the show, feel free to email info@theandrewshow.com. Once again, that's info@theandrewshow.com. And you're back here in this final segment of The Andrew Cooperator Show. And 2 days ago or so, the Herald Leader, at least online, I don't know if they published it in the paper itself, but they published an op-ed called, "Will Lexington's Flock Cameras Be Used to Police the Homeless or Track Women Leaving the State?" It's an opinion piece by one Sarah Wiley Van Meter. And so, for those of you unaware, Flock Cameras, a lot of cities are putting these up, I know, and same with automatic license plate readers too, ALRPs. And basically, they're being set up as eyes and ears around these cities to be watched by AI or individual officers and dispatchers in order to watch for problems. See, in this modern time, it's harder and harder to find a police officer because, of course, I mean, with the way you get treated, especially with the leftists involved, why would anybody want to be an officer? Those people are literally facing down the most difficult job, I think, in America. We hear about teachers never getting paid enough, but what about cops? I mean, that's a pretty iffy job. But anyways, and so because they can't attract enough officers, they're leaning more on some automated enforcement or automated watching in these flock and automatic license plate reading cameras. Now, in Kentucky, it is illegal to enforce traffic enforcements using those cameras. But right now, what they use them for is things like they'll scan license plates as they're driving through. And if a license plate is associated with somebody who has a warrant or belongs to a stolen vehicle, they'll alert the police and the police will respond. Well, apparently, the city council is looking at expanding this out and allowing more of these automatic license plate reader cameras to extend the contract, at least. They have about 100 of them in Lexington that they set up for a trial, and they're looking at continuing using those cameras. And Sarah here is writing about why we should be careful about the surveillance state. Now, if I'm to be honest, I agree about the surveillance state being troublesome. It worries me as well how easy it would be to enforce certain things. I'm thinking about things like during COVID mandates, the masking mandates to monitor a business to see if it's operating when it's not supposed to. Because one of the problems when it comes to passing any law is enforcement. And that was one of the issues with the COVID mandates. In a lot of areas, enforcement became such a problem that they just stopped enforcing it completely. How do you really enforce a mask mandate? I mean, some places tried things. I know Jessamine County attempted to hire more people into their health department to do more random checks on restaurants. And so with this automated enforcement systems, it can become a lot easier. Quoting now from the article, they say that one of my greatest concerns is how many laws have changed since these cameras were first introduced 3 years ago. Laws that make more people illegal in Kentucky and across the United States. So we already know that we're going to be in for a doozy of an article, as it talks about making more people illegal in Kentucky. Now, I don't know about you, but I haven't found any laws that make anybody illegal that Kentucky has passed. Kentucky doesn't have the ability to control any immigration law. So what does she mean by making more people illegal? She says, now quoting from the article, "Since 2021, healthcare for trans children and people needing abortions has become illegal. meaning Kentuckians seeking this health care must drive out of state to receive it. Without proper regulation into place, the movement of these vehicles can be and are being tracked by flock camera networks, not just here in Lexington, but spread across the U.S. Okay, so the assertion Sarah is making is that even though Kentucky has never passed a law, let's be clear, Kentucky has not passed a law saying that if you drive out of state to get, you know, to treat an abortion, that's illegal. And also, as far as I'm aware, they haven't made it illegal for you to go out of state if you really want to do some sort of gender surgery or get hormones for your children, you know, child abuse. Now, granted, it should be illegal for you to travel out of state just so you can legally abuse your child, but putting that to the side. But Lexington, remember, is in the middle of the state. How could Lexington flock cameras help this enforcement? Is Sarah asserting, and this is what she is asserting, that Lexington flock camera, that Kentucky flock cameras not only will be used to track people, but will be actively used to track pregnant women? And then what? If they drive out of the state? Like bounty hunters are going to go after them to drag them back for getting an abortion out of state? Is that what her claim is? That the state, a state that hasn't even made that illegal? And what say Kentucky somehow passes a law saying you can't travel out of state to go get an abortion? Though I think that would be halfway unconstitutional, possibly. It depends on some things at the federal level. But anyways, but let's say Kentucky does pass that law. Going back to what I said before, how do you enforce that? What, you're going to stop every pregnant woman leaving the state and being like, hey, where are you going? I mean, you're going to require doctors to report to the state when they have a pregnant woman? I don't think that's likely at all. What is way more likely is those laws will be used to, those cameras will be used to enforce laws that maybe she agrees with. That's why she had to go to things like tracking trans kids or women. Because the reason why I worry about those is because I think they'd be used to easily surveil on people that the government, the federal government especially, has labeled domestic enemies, domestic terrorists. I mean, we've seen, what have we seen more of, okay? Have we seen more people getting arrested for attending protests, especially on the conservative side? Where have we seen more FBI raids? Have we seen it against people who have been pro-life, people who've attended conservative protests, people who have, you know, said things online that aren't illegal, but got them labeled as terrorists? Or have we seen more people getting raided for getting a abortion? Has that ever happened? One time. I know of people that got raided by the FBI for protesting and praying outside of an abortion clinic. I have not heard of a single person getting raided by the FBI for getting an abortion. Hasn't happened. And so yet, somehow, Sarah has cooked up this alternate reality that just doesn't exist. You know, and she finishes off the article by saying about how much has changed in 3 years and what and who will become illegal in the next five. They renew the contract, the five-year contract. It is hard, overwhelming, even, to face these truths and questions. I mean, this is how these people are living. It's we are living in two totally different worlds. Like, this person, she wrote an op-ed about it and submitted it. This Sarah Wiley Van Meter. She literally sits around worrying about who will, quote-unquote, become illegal next. So because they said, you can't chop the body parts off minors, and you can't give them chemical castration drugs, And because in Kentucky, you can only get an abortion in case of the life of the mother. Because of those things happening, Sarah now sits around and wonders, who will be made illegal next? You're making their very existence illegal. Don't you know? It's absolutely crazy. And this is, we're dealing with absolutely out of control crazy people. Makes you worried about, I mean, how do we come together as a state, as a country, ever eventually when we just, recently I saw an indictment coming out of Arizona against some people involved with the Trump election. And you read through the comments and half the people say, yeah, get them, lock them up forever. Terrorists. They are people who are trying to commit treason. And the other half who are calling it out for what it is, that it's absolutely an out of control justice system. One people believe people should be in jail literally for the rest of their lives, while the other people believe that what they did is nothing wrong. But they both agree on the same facts. How do we come together there? Well, y'all, that's what I got time for today on the Andrew Cooperwriter Show and this week. We'll see you back here on Monday. I hope you have a great rest of your day and have a fantastic weekend.